Welcome to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour. This is Stephanie McPeters, the deputy editor of the Maine Monitor. The Maine Monitor is the nonpartisan, independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We're a nonprofit organization dedicated to informing Mainers through investigative and explanatory journalism and empowering them to be engaged citizens. This program is a collaboration between WERU-FM and the Maine Monitor. Each month, the Monitor's reporters and editors talk about the stories we are working on, many of which you've likely read in your local newspaper or at themainemonitor.org. Today, I'm joined by our government accountability reporter, Josh Keefe, who's here to tell us about some of his recent reporting on Maine's embattled child welfare system. So you recently did this story for us that dives pretty deep into one child protection case up in Presque Isle. And that's mainly what I want to talk about today. But before we do that, I think we need to give folks some context that'll sort of help explain what the child welfare system looks like in Maine and how it compares to other states.
I guess, first of all, it's worth saying that just about everywhere has an embattled child welfare agency. You know, I mean, there's nowhere, I don't think, in the U.S. That everyone's super happy with how it's going. So what becomes sort of difficult is to be able to compare child welfare systems across states. And it's difficult because a lot of the statistics or the data that's collected around child welfare is really dependent on the definitions that different states use. So some states might classify abuse in different ways, neglect. So it's hard to compare sort of an apples to apples. But one thing we can look at is the rate of child removal. And that's when the state removes a child from a home because of concerns about abuse or neglect, right? That's the same everywhere. If you remove a child, you remove a child. So what Maine is sort of unique in that. Between 2019 and 23, Maine's child welfare population, I'm sorry, child foster care population grew at a higher rate than anywhere else in the country. So basically, as the rest of the country was taking fewer kids into custody, Maine was taking more. Maine in 2023, which is the most recent federal data we have, was top six in the rate of removal. So Maine is increasing its foster care population and removing kids at a higher rate than just about everywhere else in the country. So that's sort of a place to start when we talk about this system, which, you know, is typically criticized for not doing enough to protect kids, not removing enough kids. I think it's worth knowing and sort of being aware of the fact that Maine's actually taking away a lot of kids compared to other states.
Right. No, I think that is a good place to start. And I think, you know, the fact that you point out that all of these systems across the country are having trouble is a good thing to note too. I mean, a lot of these agencies in Maine and across the U.S. are understaffed and under-resourced, and they're obviously wading into really complex situations when having to decide, you know, whether a child is safe or not, and that can be a complicated decision to make. You talk to the Office of Child and Family Services Director Bobby Johnson about this data. What did she have to say about it, and sort of, you know, what it says about where Maine is compared to other states?
Well, she pointed out a couple things, and other people I talked to pointed out similar data, which shows that Maine has higher than the national average rate of removals that are related to substance abuse. and then, but again, that's a little hard to know whether that means that there are, you know, there is more substance abuse in Maine than other places, or whether Maine's child welfare system has a lower tolerance for substance abuse than other states. But The other thing is, you know, Maine, she talked about Maine has a serious lack of attorneys to represent parents in these cases. Without attorneys, these cases slow down. The more cases slow down, the more they sort of pile up and the population gets larger. And, you know, also there's a real lack, as she pointed out, a real lack of behavioral and mental health support services. And those are the services that often help parents reunify with their children. It's worth pointing out that once a kid is taken into foster care, into state custody, there's a few different ways that they can sort of leave it. But the main two are they go back with their parents, which is called reunification, or they get adopted. They can also age out, but those are the two big ones. And, you know, without a lot of services in place, it's hard for parents to change the circumstances that resulted in the removal in the first place. If you don't change the circumstances, it's hard to get your child back. So Johnson, Bobby Johnson, talked about all that, but she also acknowledged that, you know, Maine had a series of really tragic child deaths in 2017 and 2018, and that the public, you know, there's a lot of public pressure and political pressure, and that's really when Maine sort of went off the national track in terms of the amount of kids or the rate of children it was removing. So I think it's hard to talk about this without acknowledging that that there really was a moment in time there where it seemed like Maine, intentionally or unintentionally, decided to start removing more kids because of a couple of really horrendous stories.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful framing, and I do think it does seem like, you know, in your reporting on this issue, a lot of you know, how the department is working now has been shaped by those deaths in 2017 and 2018. Can you just, you know, for folks who aren't familiar, maybe just tell us a little bit about them and sort of, you know, I know that some advocates and lawyers working in the field have told you that they've spurred what they would call a foster care panic. What does that mean, and sort of what have you heard from folks about that shift?
Well, it's kind of a well-known thing in child welfare nationally, which is when there's a news story about a child's death at the hand of their parents or caretakers, the system starts taking in more kids. And that's been shown, suggested in a few studies, but basically it's sort of hard to pull apart, though, how much that is because caseworkers are, you know, under pressure to make sure that doesn't happen again. They're sort of being better safe than sorry. As it's called, like, you know, it's better to take the kid out of the home, you know, if you're not sure if the kid's safe or not. But then at the same time, when those news stories, those high profile cases happen, there's more reporting of child, you know, concerns about child abuse and neglect. So the system, you know, there that sort of comes in from both ends. Both the system itself seems to be less sort of risk averse, and also the public at large, you know, has the same, you know, the same thing happens. They become more risk averse. They're more likely to report stuff. They see something that concerns them. And the problem with all this is, you know, a lot of sort of advocates who call this a foster care panic say is there's a lot of research that suggests that oftentimes children are just better at home, even with some of these problematic you know, conditions. Obviously, we're not talking about like horrific abuse and neglect, but sort of the borderline cases, it's better for children to remain at home than to be essentially ripped away from their families. So when they say foster care panic, as some academics and advocates call it, what they're saying is essentially that the system panics and just starts taking way too many kids into custody and separating way too many families. And that's, again, that's a phenomenon that's been shown throughout the country. And, you know, a lot of people nationally have pointed to the fact that that has happened in Maine.
One of the things that I know you've reported on and sort of that researchers point to when and they're thinking about this, or, you know, people, folks working in the system, is weighing the threat that's, you know, the alleged danger presented to the child against the potential harm of removal. Can you sort of walk us through what that means?
Yeah, so some states, I'm not sure about the number, but some states have passed laws that require the child welfare system or the judges that ultimately sign off on removals to weigh the potential for abuse or neglect at home versus the potential damage to the child by removing them. You know, there's you know, sort of well-established literature and research about adverse childhood experiences now, right? ACEs, they're called. And there's been a lot of research that shows basically the more traumatic experiences you have as a child, the worse your outcomes are throughout your life. And, you know, the argument is that removal from your family is an incredibly traumatic experience. So, you know, we have to weigh that against whatever's happening in the home. Some states have required that. Maine does not. There was a bill last session that would have required that. It did not really go anywhere. But so there's this idea that, you know, better safe than sorry is really a sort of you know, it's a kind of a trap that you can fall into in child welfare. So really what we're talking about a lot of these cases is neglect, not necessarily abuse. I think about two-thirds to three-quarters of child removal in Maine is due to neglect. And neglect can be a pretty subjective term. And so the argument goes along from, you know, a lot of lawyers who represent parents and advocates and people involved in the system who want reforms, is that a lot of times we're removing kids from conditions of poverty that are not the fault of the parents. They're not choosing to neglect their child. They just don't have the resources that, you know, a lot of sort of the middle class voters and politicians and social workers would expect. And the argument there is, well, let's not remove the child and, you know, pay for lawyers and foster foster care and all the things you need when you remove a child. Instead, let's just help that family and provide them with resources so they can alleviate those conditions. But yeah, you know, it's hard to tell how many. You know, I've asked people, like, how many cases are on that kind of poverty versus neglect spectrum that kind of could go any way, or kind of eye of the beholder. And, you know, no one really agrees on sort of what percentage of the system that is.
Right. And it is such a complicated thing to untangle. And it's obviously connected to a lot of deficiencies, you know, other deficiencies in the social safety net. And so, you know, we talked at the beginning, you mentioned that one of the things OCFS Director Bobby Johnson pointed to was the lack of services. And that's kind of what it comes down to here, right? If you think, if a caseworker were to find some case where they thought, like, really this, you know, this is just a situation where the family is really struggling to get by, and it's not intentional neglect of their children. And if we were able to connect them with, you know, some sort of food bank and some sort of other support services, then they could, take care of their children much better. Is that the kind of thing we're talking about?
Yeah, it's that, and it's also can be things like substance abuse counseling, mental health counseling. It can be sort of a wide variety of things. But yeah, I mean, there's also just there's also research that shows basically that when you reduce poverty, you reduce child welfare cases. I think there was, I'm sort of going off the top of my head here, but I think there was a study a few years ago that basically showed, when you raise the minimum wage, child welfare cases go down. So much of this is poverty, even if it's not, as simple as, oh, they didn't have their car broke down, they couldn't afford to fix it. So they missed the doctor's appointment. So the doctor called DHHS, and there's sometimes it's not as simple as that. It's more complicated. People who live in poverty have to deal with all sorts of issues that bubble up in all these different ways and affect your mental health and everything else. But I think the ultimate point is that removing a child is, if it can be helped by putting other things in places, it should be avoided. I mean, that is really the heart of the child welfare system. Even in Maine, everywhere, it's the goal is always to reunify. Under the law, the goal is to reunify with the parents, right? To help them overcome whatever conditions led to involvement in the first place. But that's hard when there's no services in place, and basically all you're telling your parents is sort of figure it out. A lot of parents, if it was that simple, they would have done it in order to keep their child in the first place.
Yes, it is all very complicated, and the story which we're going to get into a little later in this conversation, I think does speak to how complex these cases can be. You are listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU FM. Today, I'm joined by government accountability reporter Josh Keefe, who's been digging into the state's child welfare system. So, Josh, just to go back to this question of, neglect and poverty, I understand Governor Mills recently signed a bill that changes Maine's definition of child neglect. Can you tell us what that looks like?
Yeah, so the bill is essentially puts in a sort of exception for poverty. So what it does is it basically says you if you can't provide sort of the necessities for your ch child because you lack the resources, or you've been offered the resources. Or sorry, if because you lack the resources, that means that it is not neglect under the law. This is something that federal government under Biden kind of asked the states to adopt. A lot of states already had this, some for years in their statutes. This was supported by DHHS. So this is sort of everybody, all the stakeholders were sort of on board with this. But the there was other bills at the legislature that would have gone a little bit further. A lot of sort of advocates saw this as like, well, it's a good step, but like we're it's sort of very small incremental level change that some of them thought wouldn't have much of an effect. But yeah, there was this other another bill that would have gone a lot further. Right now, Maine's law does not require abuse or neglect to have happened to get child welfare involved and to potentially remove your child. It's just if it's likely to happen, or the potential to happen. And a lot of states don't have that. A lot of states, you have to have actually, they have to actually show that you abuse or neglect your child. They can't just sort of say it seems like you're about to or otherwise likely to. So there was a bill that would have changed that would have taken away that kind of potentiality in the law. That did not make it out of committee. It's definitely sort of, I think, step in the right direction. Everyone seems to agree on that. How much actual impact it will have, sort of remains to be seen.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you for talking us through that. Just going back to, this data a little bit and your conversation mm-hmm. with Bobby Johnson, according to the data from the state that we have, which is a little more updated than the federal data, the foster care population in Maine is starting to decline, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That is right. So the federal data is through the end of 2023. So that's really useful for comparison purposes to other states. But obviously it's lagging. So what Maine does have a child welfare dashboard where you can every few months they update with the amount of kids in state custody. So from the end of 2023, Maine's foster care population did continue to grow. It actually hit a 20-year high in July 2024. About over 2,500 kids in custody. But that has been declining since and was down to 2,290 as of April 1st. So it seems like, that trend that sort of put Maine kind of as, really an outlier compared to other states seems to be reversing. At least, it's a little early to tell, but Director Johnson called that, a positive movement. I kind of asked her what, why that was. She said that there have been more adoptions. Obviously, if kids are adopted out of the system, that makes the population go down. And Maine does have according to 2023 data, Maine does have a higher rate of children leaving the system through adoption than the national average. But she also talked about the department trying to identify barriers to either adoption or reunification, making a concerted effort to try to figure out in individual cases where the problems were, whether it was in the the courts or in the child welfare in DHHS itself. And she also credited investments in the state's behavioral health system. Which is sort of some of those resources we were talking about before. There has been some investment in that recently. I think there's still a long way to go, but certainly more than there were a few years ago. So I think the hope is that as we continue to build that system out, we will be able to reunify more kids with their families. But again, we're talking. It was only a year ago where we were at a 20-year high. I will say too, just real quick, Director Johnson, she's been with DHHS for a long time, but she just became the director. She was on an interim basis. She was a director a little bit before that, but I think at the beginning of last year. So her tenure is pretty new. So there is new leadership as well. It's kind of worth mentioning.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And did she talk about sort of what, any changes to the approach that she's making or thinking about in the work?
Yeah, it's kind of tough. I think what they're, I don't think there's any huge changes. This is sort of trying to steer a cruise ship or some large, it's hard. You can't really make hairpin turns here. And I think what she talked about, she did talk about though, was trying to be proactive instead of reactive, and that they've worked with some national groups about trying to not let those kind of stories that we talked about, as tragic as they may be, not to sort of swerve back and forth between extremes of, taking too many children, not taking away enough, but to try to kind of create, a sustainable model moving forward. Because that's another sort of cliche that you hear a lot talking about child welfare is people talk about the pendulum, right? That depending on politics or, news stories, there's a pendulum of removing a lot of kids on one end and not removing enough kids on the other, and that child welfare systems, across the country often swing back and forth. And what you talk about is trying to essentially stop that and kind of find, a long-term approach that is sustainable and that isn't just reacting, that's more proactive.
Another piece that, I think it's important for people to understand before we dive into this one case is just how secretive the system is and how rare it is to get a window into how these child protection cases play out, even for lawmakers. Can you just tell us a little bit about this sort of secretive system and this lack of transparency and what that looks like?
Yeah, so child welfare cases are confidential, right? And there's good reason for that. The idea these are children, their parents have not been in the vast majority of cases have not been convicted of any crime. We are the system is designed to protect those people. But that being said, it's also, I think in each individual case, we can understand the reasons for that, right? But in the aggregate, what it does is it creates a system in which the government can wield a tremendous amount of power outside of public scrutiny. So Maine is, like every other state, Maine is subject to federal laws, which basically say, in order to get federal funding, you need to have a system in place that keeps records of child welfare cases confidential. That's narrower, I think, than a lot of departments like to admit. A lot of departments like to kind of say, we can't tell, we can't say anything about any cases or the federal government will come at us. Well, the federal government's never really come at any state for that. And, the money is never, I don't think, ever been turned off anywhere for that reason. But it's a good excuse to, not have to show your work. So that being said, Maine, there are some states where the hearings, even though the records are secret, the hearings, the court proceedings are open. You can go in, you can sit in the court, and you can watch child welfare cases. Maine is not one of those states. You cannot go into the courtroom and watch these cases play out. I have tried, I've been kicked out. And Maine also, even the Government Oversight Committee at the legislature, right, when they were investigating some of these child deaths from 2017, 2018, they tried to get some of those records and ended up going to the Maine Supreme Court, which ruled against them, saying that they couldn't have them. So, yeah, it's hard to look at these cases. And that's part of the reason why, these really tragic deaths have such an outsized influence, right? I mean, not that we shouldn't, care deeply about them, but we don't see any other cases. We only see cases when there's, if there's a death and then it enters the criminal justice system, which is open. So it's really hard to see cases that don't enter the criminal justice system in some way. And as a result, I think we don't really have a sense of what this work is, of what caseworkers do. I think if you talk to caseworkers, it's, they're either, they deal with people who, you know, when they meet in their regular life and talk about what they do, you know, people either assume they snatch children away or, you know, that they're not doing enough to protect children. Like there's no sort of understanding of what the actual work is. So what I've really wanted to try to do for a while now was find a case where I could really kind of lay out how the system works, how families can try to get their kids back, what kind of decisions caseworkers have to make, how the system, how the child welfare system interacts with the courts. Because it's you know, it's not just DHHS, it's also the courts and the lawyers and the Attorney General's office, which represents DHHS in court. So anyway, it's, you know, the only way to really get in there is to talk to parents who are willing to tell their story, but I think even more importantly, willing to show you all the records, willing to show you the things that don't make them look great, because otherwise, you know, you're kind of only getting one side of it. So that's what I try to do here. And yeah, it's a tough system to sort of crack, but I think it's worth trying to do so.
Yeah, no, thank you for setting the stage there. And now let's, you know, let's talk about this case. It, you know, just tell us first, you know, how did you hear about it and what prompted you to sort of dig in?
I heard about it from some lawyers up north in Aroostook County. You know, it turns out that the woman involved wanted to tell her story. So what this case is, it's pretty complicated, but the sort of overview is, it's a woman who, she says spanked her child in the parking lot of the grocery store in Presque Isle. There was a witness at the scene who called the police, who said, the witness said she saw, the woman, her name is Micah Adler, hit her child in the lower back, basically in this parking lot. Micah said that the kid ran toward traffic and that she bent down and spanked him in order to teach him not to do that again. Anyway, there's video of it. It's not quite clear. It's kind of an eye of the beholder type of thing. But what happened is she was arrested. She was charged with domestic violence, aggravated assault initially, which can carry a sentence of up to 10 years in prison. And her child was taken away by DHHS. And ultimately, I mean, there's sort of, I'm skipping a lot here, but I think it's important to know, ultimately what happened is DHHS ended up dropping the case against her, the child protection case. She took her criminal case to court, to a jury trial, and the jury found her not guilty. But because of all sorts of different twists and turns, she basically never got custody of her child back, even though she kind of won in the legal sense in both of her, in the parallel child protective and criminal cases. So that's sort of I'll stop there, but that's sort of the I wish was shorter overview of that case.
Yeah, no, that is, it's hard to summarize I don't know what the final word count was ultimately, 5,500 word story in a couple sentences, but I think that is the sort of high level overview. You know, I think, like you said, one of the reasons you really wanted to dig into this piece is to sort of walk people through and just understand, you know, ourselves, what navigating a child protection case, and in this case, a child protection case and a criminal case simultaneously, looks like. What did it look like for Mike Adler?
Well, I think the first thing to sort of know about Micah is she is she's a bit of, I guess, what you call a free spirit. She bought this tract of land up in Rustic County, and got a tiny house delivered there, just a small one room sort of shed. Had her Amish neighbors with their horses help bring it up there, and she sort of started to live this kind of off the grid life. She had a stove in there for heat. She had a well. So yeah, and she lived out there with her child, who was 3 years old when all this went down. So for her, part of the removal was because of what happened in the parking lot, but it was also partly because of sort of the conditions of her tiny house, and the child who had some tooth decay according to DHHS records. That was also another reason they removed him. This, I think, a lot of this case, she had to kind of fight to get her child back. She had to subject herself to, not subject herself, but she had to kind of do everything that the department asked. She found her own she found her own therapist. That was a thing they asked, but she didn't wait for them to refer one. She anticipated that they were going to ask her, found one, started going, went to parenting classes again before she was sort of ordered to do so. She made all these adjustments to her tiny house, put in shelves and composting toilet, and then different sort of adjustments to the stove to make it safer to have a child around. She had a shed so she could she had a shed so she could put the kind of bio brick fuel she used in the stove. She had a bunch of different things, but ultimately, she never got to go in front of a judge and argue her case fully. I mean, there's an initial sort of appearance, but and the child was in foster care for months and months, and the system, how the child welfare system works, is it centers around a concept called Jeopardy, which, as far as I can tell, is kind of, at least that word is sort of unique to Maine. But basically, once your child is removed, you have, under Maine law, within 120 days, a court has to find Jeopardy, which is that you, as a parent, are creating conditions of jeopardy for your child. So your child is in danger, essentially. There's 120 days. And after that, basically, if you don't get a jeopardy finding by then, the case is over and you get your child back. In her case, she never got to that point. The case actually dragged on for 200 some days. And then they dropped it right before there was a Jeopardy hearing scheduled. So, that's I'm kind of you feel free to stop me anytime here, but that's sort of at the heart of this is the case dragged on. They never really proved it, proved anything against her, but she still was without her child for a long time. And basically what happened is they found the father, and put the child with the father, and then closed case, saying like, well, we've reunited the child with his dad, so we're good, and then just kind of walked away. And now Micah and the father are sort of fighting it out for custody in court.
Yeah, well, there's a lot to dig into here. I know it's hard to summarize. You are listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU FM. Today, I'm joined by Government Accountability reporter Josh Keefe, who's been digging into the state's child welfare system. He's talking right now about a case he just dove into up in Presque Isle. So, Josh, we explained in the piece that your account is based on police reports, body cameras, surveillance footage, court filings, transcripts, and DHHS records provided by the mother, as well as interviews with her lawyers, and the child's father, who you just mentioned. There's a couple things I think we should unpack for folks here, but one of the reasons this case was so interesting to look at from a reporting perspective is, again, coming back to this question of transparency, is that you had access to a lot of information because the mother was willing to share her story and the DHHS records, but also because it wasn't just a child protection case. There was this criminal element, and so you had access to more records because of that. Can you talk us through that a little bit?
Yeah, so because there was a criminal case, criminal cases are public in a way that child protective cases are not. So there was, discovery in that case, which included the video from the surveillance footage from the grocery store of the incident in question, which she said was a spanking. And a witness who, it's worth mentioning, the witness saw it through her side view mirror, said Micah was punching her child in the lower back, which, her Micah's defense attorney in the trial pointed out how, does who punches a child in the lower back? Like, does that really make sense? But anyway, because it was a criminal trial, there was all these ways sort of into the case. There were medical records about the child who was fine. He was not hurt by that at all. And there was also, there was body camera footage of the police who were there while a DHHS caseworker was interviewing Micah when they first came to her house to remove her child. And then there was a trial. So that's even more evidence because, there's a transcript of the witnesses and cross-examination and everything else. So the fact that there was essentially a criminal trial about the exact thing that the child protective case was about really opened up sort of the avenues to get information and to understand it in a way that just a child protective case by itself, would not allow.
Yeah, and we should mention, just to sort of be clear, that you did reach out to DHHS and the AG's office about the story, but they weren't able to share really much information at all because of the confidential nature of these records and cases. Is that right?
Yeah, I did ask them about, that's right. But I asked them about sort of some I guess I'll say, I don't want to say theoretical, but sort of their
More
practices,
procedural things.
procedural
Yeah.
question that applied to this case. For example, during while Micah's child was in foster care, she told me that the first place he was placed with, the first foster family, she got a call from a DHHS caseworker who said that they were moving the child to another foster placement because they got a report that one of the foster parents had slapped the child. I guess, in public, and somebody had called. This is what was her understanding. So, these cases are secrets, so it's hard to confirm that. What I was able to, Micah showed me text messages and emails where she's trying to get more information from DHHS caseworkers about this alleged incident, and they're basically saying, "Yeah, we can't really share anything. That's kind of with the licensing department." So they never deny that it happens, or telling her, or challenge her the way she described it. But I was able to confirm, ask DHHS. They are able to say if somebody is a licensed foster care parent, or it's actually called a resource parent, but it's a foster parent in Maine. And they were able to confirm that these two people were, as of now, no longer licensed resource parents in Maine. So, you know, there are examples in reporting this kind of thing where, you know, you might not be able to fully confirm, you know, every single thing because of confidentiality, but, you know, you can try to sort of, I guess, reduce the possibilities, you know, try to kind of work around some of that as best you can. And, you know, in the story, I hope we made clear, you know, what we knew for a fact versus, you know, what Micah told us. I will say, I don't think there was anything in the course of many hours of speaking with her and going through records and criminal, I don't think she ever, I can't think of anything that she told me that was, I later found out was, you know, demonstrably false. But, you know, there obviously is a big difference between what somebody tells you as a reporter and what you can prove to be true. So it's challenging in these kind of cases, but, you know, you try to confirm it as best you can.
Right. And that's part of why we lay out at the beginning of the story and then sort of throughout what your source for each piece of information is, whether it's coming from body camera footage, whether it's coming from, you know, what Micah is telling you or from the DHHS record she shared or from text messages that you were able to see, things like that. Because I do think it's obviously a very complicated case and people's perspectives are different. And that's just sort of the nature of reporting on this kind of thing. But we, you know, did our best, obviously, to bolster everything and fact check it as much as we could. And to just be clear with readers about, you know, what, like you said, what we really were able to confirm through records and the like, and what, you know, was being told to us. So on that, you know, on that note, you spent a long time talking to Micah Adler over the course of a couple months, and you went up to Presque Isle and you were able to visit her tiny home. Can you tell us about that and sort of how you approach these sensitive conversations?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think, you know, in terms of how I approached it, you know, I think the only way to do it is just try to be as honest as possible, which, you know, is to say basically, you know, I want to tell your story, and she wanted it told, which is how we sort of were able to connect. But, you know, it's also, you know, I always try to tell people when I'm telling their story, like, you know, we, to make it clear up front, like, we have different interests here. You know, I want to tell your story, you want to tell your story, but at the end of the day, you know, my obligation is to the truth and to, you know, sort of as much objective fact and reality as I can. And that's sometimes going to maybe clash with how you see your own experience, how you know want to be perceived. So I try to, you know, make that as clear as I can. And Micah understood that. You know, I think she was, I told her everything that was going to be in this story, including stuff that, you know, I think, maybe, you know, made her look less sympathetic at times. But she's a very smart, perceptive person. And it was my takeaway anyway. And, you know, I think she was very clear-eyed about what this story would be, and understanding that by putting herself out there, you know, there were going to be the DHHS allegations. We're going to be sort of public. So yeah, I mean, there were some, I guess, tough conversations, but, you know, it's, I guess with a story like this, you're never going to be able to write it, without the person wanting to tell it, you know? So it was definitely, I don't think there were any sort of gotcha moments, but, you know, I think we have to discuss all the sort of everything that's involved, including things that are kind of uncomfortable, but, you know, I just try to be upfront about that as possible. I mean, it's a tough conversation. She's been through a lot. Her child has been through a lot. And, you know, you try to be sensitive to that and, you know, give people out, you know, if it's, you know, we don't have to talk about this right now, you know, and try to be, you know, not just a robot about it, but be a human being. But anyway, sort of going on here, but yeah, I mean, I think ultimately a lot of it comes down to a certain level of courage of the subject to tell their story. And so as a reporter, you know, you can only hope for a subject who has that kind of courage and understanding of why being objective and sort of fair is actually the best thing in the end, as opposed to sort of, you know, just allowing somebody to tell their story and not fact checking or not pushing back, you know.
Right. No, this is very different from someone, you know, going on Facebook and just sharing their own, you know, their own story, and they can say whatever they, you know, whatever they want. In this case, like, you are, you know, you're listening to what they have to say, and then you're looking at, you know, the records, and you're talking to other people, you're talking to her lawyers, you're talking, you know, to other folks to try and sort of piece together this puzzle. And like you said, you were honest with her and upfront with her about ultimately what, you know, what was in the article. And that's part of our fact checking process, that we sort of, you know, we don't share the story beforehand with sources. We're not giving sources control over what's in the piece, but we're, you know, going through to confirm that, you know, we have things right. And that is something that we have the time to do. And so I think it is important, you know, to sort of, to have people understand that. And, you know, as part of that, you spoke to the child's father, who, you know, had a very different perspective. What did he have to say?
Well, he, so I guess to explain a little bit about, I guess I sort of have to explain how they were involved a little bit, but basically there's two sort of competing versions of how they came to parent this child together. Micah said that they essentially had an agreement that he would father her child, and then she agreed to sort of never put his name on any paperwork, on the birth certificate. You know, he had no, with the goal being that he would have no legal obligation, but you know, he could visit the child and be in his life as much as he wanted. What he said was that they were essentially friends and hooked up, and then she had a kid, and he thought it was possible the kid was his, but he never really knew one way or another. And then she kind of disappeared upstate to Roosted County. They were in Rumford at the time. So there's two pretty different versions here, but what we can agree on is that at a hearing, an early hearing in her child protective trial, Micah was threatened with contempt of court if she didn't reveal the identity of the father. And she did. And a judge ordered a DNA test, a paternity test of the father. And it took, according to him, it took, I think, 3 or 4 months for them to show up at his work and serve him with that order, which he understand. I mean, the child was in foster care that entire time. And he was sort of like, you know, I've lived in the same place and we're in the same place forever. I'm not hiding. Like, you could have just found me very easily. Anyway, the paternity test came back. You know, he was the father. After he got involved in the case, DHHS basically gave him the child and then closed the case shortly thereafter. So anyway, his perspective was that essentially Micah had hid out in the woods and had, you know, neglected his child unbeknownst to him, and that he didn't understand why DHHS just gave him the kid and closed the case. He wanted the child, but he didn't understand how after everything that happened, they just closed the case and then allowed them to sort of fight out custody with private attorneys, by the way, which is a big difference. In a child protective case, the state pays for your attorney. You know, once it's a custody battle, you're sort of on your own money wise. So he thought he was. I mean, Micah is very critical about how DHHS handled everything. So was the father. You know, he couldn't believe they took so long to just do a basic DNA test and get him involved, and then when they did, they just walked away from it all. So yeah, I mean, it's funny. It's not funny at all, but you know, they're both very critical of DHHS for sort of exactly opposite reasons.
Yeah, no, that's good to point out, and it's, you know, I think that was an important piece of the story, obviously, that you got his perspective. Well, we're basically at time. I know we could, you know, we could keep talking about this for a long time. Just to kind of wrap things up, so the parents are now, like you said, negotiating custody, basically. Right. Yeah. Okay.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, thank you for this conversation, Josh. And you know, I know this is something that you're gonna continue to look into and report on, so people have a lot of other, you know, stories sort of in this sphere to, you know, I shouldn't say look forward to, because they're not, you know, that kind of story, but they are important work.
Well, thank you, Stephanie, and thank you for wrangling this conversation into shape the same way you wrangled the story into shape. I appreciate it.
All right. You've been listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, a collaboration between WERU FM and the nonpartisan independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. To read Josh's stories and learn more about our reporting, visit themainemonitor.org. Questions or comments related to the radio program can be sent to news@weru.org. The Maine Monitor Radio Hour is broadcast on the first Thursday of every month at 4 p.m. You can also listen on the WERU app, subscribe to the show as a podcast, or download archive shows at weru.org. For the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, I'm Stephanie McPheeters, and this is Community Radio WERU FM 89.9 Blue Hill. Thanks for listening.